This Is Your Life, episode 25.
This is your life. Are you who you wanna be?
Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt, and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. In this episode, I'm going to be talking about what you can do to build a successful, long-term marriage. I've been married now for 34 years, and this is something I care about very, very much. But first, this podcast is brought to you by Dynamic Communicators International, producers of the SCORE, Launch, and Platform conferences. These unique events are designed for professional speakers and those who simply want to communicate more professionally. They provide the tools you need to take your speaking and your speaking career to the next level. The next SCORE conference is scheduled for October the 17th through the 20th in Vail, Colorado at the beautiful Park Hyatt at Beaver Creek. We had the conference at this location last year and it was amazing. It was an incredible conference in a gorgeous setting, and I'm going to be there the whole week along with my partner, Ken Davis. And in addition to the formal instruction and the small group coaching, which will be excellent, Ken and I'll just be hanging out with the attendees. We've had some amazing discussions at the evening receptions. Gives you an opportunity to ask your questions, to discuss the projects that you're interested in. And we've got a lot of time together, whether it's over a meal or at those evening receptions. But for more information, go to scoreconference.com. And that's SCORE with two R's. So this last week was awesome. Gail and I spent 4 days in the Rocky Mountains over the Labor Day weekend with a handful of friends. We've done this every year now for 9 years, and we had such a great time. All of us have been married a really long time. In fact, one couple, Scott and Jill Bolander, just a little shout out to them, were celebrating their 40th anniversary, and they're still very much in love. But at dinner one night, I asked them, what are the two or three habits that you've practiced to create the kind of amazing marriage that that you have? And they gave us three great examples. And I'm just going to share with you one that they shared with us. This is just terrific. In fact, I told Scott, you have got to write a book. But daily, they practice what they call the habit of reintroduction. And their basic idea was that every day we grow as individuals. We change. We're not the same people today as we were yesterday. It happens incrementally. It's usually not sudden. But we've got to keep reintroducing ourselves to one another so we don't suddenly wake up and discover that we're married to a very different person than the one we started with. So every night before they go to bed, they sit down and they have a cup of tea together and they share how they've changed that day. And it encourages regular, intimate dialogue. And I just thought that was such a great idea. Gail and I don't do exactly that, but we started practicing that, just talking at the end of the day about how we've changed since the day before. And it's been terrific. So anyway, we had this amazing conversation about marriage. Then Gail and I came down from the mountain. We came back to town to the news that another friend's marriage was crumbling. And this has been now several this year, but his wife had just asked for a divorce and he was totally caught off guard. And the sad part is that there are several young children involved. Last year, I watched another friend's marriage blow up when his wife discovered that he had yet another affair. It was his second, but his family and his friends, including me, are still reeling from the devastating effect of it. And I'm sure he is as well, but it has a consequence. And I began to think about my podcast this week and I thought, I've got to do something on marriage. This again is something I care about deeply. It is related to leadership. In fact, the condition of your marriage has everything to do with your happiness as an individual and your effectiveness as a leader. And in fact, whether you realize it or not, the people you lead observe your marriage and they draw several conclusions about you and your leadership. They learn about your priorities by watching you in the context of your marriage and your family. They learn how you treat the people who are closest to you, which is hugely important as they consider whether or not they're going to continue to work for you. They learn whether it's all about you or you're a team player, and all of that just from watching your marriage. And this is why I always take an employee candidate to dinner with their spouse. Whenever I'm interviewing somebody or considering someone for an important position, I take them to dinner with their spouse because I want to observe how they are together. This will tell me more than I could learn from several interviews and a battery of psychological tests, both of which I recommend, by the way. But a dinner with the spouse really reveals a lot. And there have been people that frankly had made it through the hurdle of the interviews. The psychological tests looked good, but we didn't have a positive dinner. And I just bailed because there was something intuitive that told me something important about that person as a prospective employee by virtue of the marriage that they had created or not created it. And frankly, as a practical matter, if they've got problems in their marriage, it's probably going to show up at work. It's going to require additional time. There's going to be a loss of focus, and they're just not going to be as effective, as productive as they could be if they had a good marriage. And I realize that marriages are not something static. They go up and down. Some days are better than others. Some weeks, some years are better than others. But in general, I want to hire people that are in good, stable marriages because I do believe they make better employees. Or to say it another way, if people aren't in good, stable marriages, there's going to be an effect on the organization. So as a corporation or as a nonprofit ministry, you have a vested interest in the quality of the marriages of your key people. So unfortunately, the chances of you making your marriage work long time are about 50-50. In other words, you face a very real risk of divorce. And if you think otherwise, you know, I hate to say it, I don't mean to be offensive, but you're frankly being naive. If your marriage is going to survive and thrive, you're going to have to be, like I've said about everything, intentional about it. Great marriages don't just happen. They're created just like your health, just like your career success, just like your financial well-being. Now, I have not figured out everything about marriage, as my wife will tell you. In fact, I regularly screw up, but I've been married for 34 years. And I love my wife, Gail, more today than I did when I got married. In fact, I don't think I had a clue what love was when I got married. She's my very best friend in the world. We love being together. We love being parents and we love being grandparents. We are in a great season of life. So what I want to share with you today comes out of the crucible of our own experience. I learned a lot of what I know about marriage the old-fashioned way by what John Maxwell calls failing forward. I have made tons of mistakes. I've not always been the husband I should have been or the father that I should have been. And I continue to make tons of mistakes. You know, it's not perfect by a long shot, but it is a healthy, stable marriage. And so I'm speaking out of my experience. And here's my premise for this episode. In order to build a successful long-term marriage, you need to make four commitments. So let's get to them. Number one, commit to continuing education. And there's a number of ways to do this, but let me just expand on this. First of all, become a student of your spouse. Look, you're different, duh. But how are you different? This is going to take you a lifetime to unpack and to explore because your spouse is always changing. Even if they were static, given what human personality is and human nature is, it would probably take you a lifetime. But the fact is, it's a moving target. Your spouse is constantly changing. A friend said to me today, you know, she's just not the same woman I married. Really? I hope not. I hope to God I'm not the same man my wife married. I've worked hard to change that. And I'm thankful that my wife is not the same woman I married. Like a fine wine, she's just getting better with age. And so I would start by taking the Strengths Finder test, both of you, which I discussed in episode 23 of this podcast, and that will give you a background, but it's a wonderful place to start because it will give you your five top strengths and will enable you as a couple to focus not only on how you're different, but where you're stronger together than you are separately. Well, in addition to becoming a student of your spouse, I'd encourage you to read books or, as I do, listen to the audiobooks when I run. You know, you can kill two birds with one stone doing it that way. But just a few that I would recommend that have been helpful to me. Love and Respect by Emerson Eggerichs is a fantastic book. I read it with my mentoring group. I recommend it as the first book that every couple reads, but it's an excellent book on sort of the differences in the way that we have to relate to one another as couples and how to get out of what Emerson calls the crazy cycle that we often get into as couples. So Love and Respect, Sacred Marriage by Gary Thomas. And let me just say that this is a Christian book. It's a very Christian book. I'm a Christian. I'm not trying to press my values on you, but it comes from that worldview. And then The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman, realizing that there are a variety of ways that we express love and receive love. And it's important to know what our spouse receives as love, and then give them what they need. So read books, attend conferences. Emerson has a terrific conference called the Love and Respect Conference. Gail and I have been to it. It was just superb. Gary Smalley's seminars, anything that he does is excellent. His work in marriage has been great because he synthesizes so much of the research and makes it very practical. He puts the cookies down on the shelf where you can reach them. Just by the way, a footnote, Gary and his wife Norma are the ones that introduced Gail and me to one another now 35 years ago. And Gary actually performed our wedding ceremony. So we owe a huge debt to him. And then if you've really got a marriage that needs 911 attention, maybe you're really struggling, you're on the edge of divorce, I would recommend a intensive workshop called SaveMyMarriage.com, or at least that's where you can go to find out more about it. And I'll have a link in the show notes. But this is an intensive 3-day seminar. I've not been. I've had a couple of friends go. In both cases, it saved their marriages. They say they have a 75% success rate, but it's very intense. But it's also very helpful, and they give you the practical tools that can help you dig out and make your marriage better. So again, become a student of your spouse, read books, attend conferences. The last thing I would say under this whole idea of committing to continuing education is get counseling. You know, find a licensed marriage and family therapist. Both parties, when they come to a marriage, bring themselves with their hurts, their wounds, their successes, their strengths, their weaknesses. I mean, it's an entire package. And so much of you becoming a different person and growing and becoming all that you were meant to be is you're working that out in the context of marriage is trying to deal with your own junk. And sometimes that just takes counseling. I remember when I went to a therapist for the first time, he said, Mike, the healthy people come to me. The people that are really unhealthy, they won't darken the door of a counselor. So don't think it's an admission of weakness because you go to a counselor. The healthy people get counseling because they want to get better, just like sick people who want to get better go to a doctor. And oftentimes, a counselor can really help you sort through the events of your life, figure it all out so that you can move forward and have a positive, productive life. And I would just say that when you go to a therapist, get a referral from your pastor or get a referral from a friend, because not all counselors are created equal. They're not all the same. Not all of them are equally helpful. In fact, in some cases, they can be detrimental if you're not careful. So I would just say, avail yourself of that resource, but be thoughtful and intentional, as I always say, in selecting a counselor. So number one commitment is you got to commit to continuing education. Second commitment is commit to spending time together. If you're taking notes, here's how you spell invest, like investing time. T-I-M-E. You've got to make time for one another if you're going to have a successful long-term marriage. It's amazing to me that so many people are willing to invest such enormous spiritual, emotional, and financial resources in relationships other than the ones they have. And this is exactly what happens in the case of adultery. Rather than people investing the resources they have in their own marriage and making it better, they invest it in somebody else and it never ends up being better. There's a horrific cost that no one counts. I remember hearing years ago, somebody said, you know, the grass is not greener on the other side. Or he said, I think I may have that backwards. The grass is, we always think it's greener on the other side, but it still has to be mowed. And that's the case. After the emotion settles out and life becomes routine and some of the adventure wears off, then life becomes very daily. And again, you have to confront yourself, because no matter where you are, there you go. You take yourself into every relationship. And the other thing I would say is it just doesn't make economic sense. If you want your marriage to grow and flourish, you're going to have to invest in it. This means investing time, dreaming, laughing, listening, crying together, but just spending time to do this. And there are several practical ways to do this. For one, and you probably heard this 1,000 times before, but it's something that Gail and I have practiced and something I would recommend, and that is have a date night, a time when you just go out, the two of you, to be together. And I'm going to talk about some practical ways to do this in a little bit. But even a weekend getaway doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be far, but a time when you have a more extended period without the children where you can focus on one another. Traveling together, I really, through my history, I couldn't always do this when the kids were really small, but once they got old enough to farm out, we traveled a lot together. And it's very rare, frankly, for Gail and I not to travel together today, but we love sharing experiences, those extended times of talking when we're on the road together. It's fantastic. And then a couple only vacation. And I, some of you are listening to this and you're thinking, well, that's fine for you to say, you know, you can afford that. We can't afford a vacation. I want to challenge you on that. And I want to challenge you to become creative about doing it. Even if it's a staycation or if it's only a few days, but you need time, extended time to focus on one another. And throughout our married life, we've said we want to have one vacation a year that is really the family, maybe two vacations as I got further along in my career and had 3 weeks to spend, but a couple only vacation where it was just the two of us without the kids, where we could focus on one another. Again, that's not going to be possible for everybody, but it should be an aspiration for everyone. And when you're together, become fascinated with learning about your spouse. And as I said earlier, you know, you can commit to a lifetime of this, but ask questions. More importantly, become an expert at asking the second question. This is what's really important, going deeper in the relationship and not just asking a perfunctory question like, how are you doing? But then when they give an answer, then asking, so how did that make you feel? Or tell me what happened next? Or something that takes the conversation down another level. And I love the way that my wife does this. I hope I've also learned some of this, but I see it even in my daughters, how they ask questions and how they ask the second question. And we tried to practice this around the dinner table as the girls were growing up. So the second commitment is to commit to spending time together. Third commitment, commit to set specific boundaries. The opportunity for adultery has never been greater. I mean, there's more interaction with men and women in the marketplace. There's more opportunity to meet someone attractive of the opposite sex. This is just part of our culture today. And the consequences are huge. I don't have to tell you this, I'm sure, because you probably witnessed it firsthand. Hopefully you haven't experienced it, but maybe you have. There's no faster way to destroy your legacy than this. It can take years to recover from it. And the problem is that most people don't start with an intention to commit adultery. They don't. I mean, most people don't wake up in the morning and think, you know, today I think I'm going to have an affair and it's going to ruin my relationship with my children, not to mention my spouse. It's going to have consequences at work. I'll probably spend years trying to recover from this. No, instead they fall into it. And do not think you're beyond temptation. You're not. Given the right set of circumstances, most of us would or could succumb to this temptation. So I think the first thing that we need to do is that we need to be aware of our own propensity, our own biology, our own hormones. I mean, this is not always, you know, something that has a malicious intent. We can fall into it in the right circumstances if we're not smart, more importantly, if we're not wise. Well, one key is making sure you don't ever find yourself in those circumstances. For example, if you have an alcohol addiction, it's probably not going to be a good idea for you to hang out in bars or keep alcohol in the house. If you've got a problem with your weight or with your health, it's probably not a good idea to keep your refrigerator stocked with junk food or high-calorie processed snacks. Instead, you want to set yourself up for success and avoid setting yourself up for failure. So I suggest establishing a specific set of boundaries for your marriage. And this is something that Gail and I have done and something I highly recommend. And it may sound old-fashioned, perhaps even a little legalistic. So be it. I think our world could use a little old-fashioned common sense, don't you? I have three boundaries that I try to live by. Number one, I will not go out to eat alone with someone of the opposite sex. I just won't. That's rule number one. Boundary number two, and probably boundaries is a better idea than rule, but boundary number two is I will not travel alone with someone of the opposite sex. I just don't. I haven't done that in my work, And I don't do it to this day. Number three, I will not flirt with someone of the opposite sex. And this is probably the biggest temptation. Some people just have flirtatious personalities. It's easy when the sexual chemistry gets going to just kind of flirt with somebody. And it's usually under the guise of humor. But I just don't do that. I don't think I'm a boring person to be around. I try to be fun. I try to have humor. But there's a difference between that and flirting. And you know where the line is. You know when you slip over into it. But I've written about this in the past, and a few people took offense, so I want to take a moment to address that. They said that I was denying women the same opportunities as men by having this set of boundaries and practicing them in my career. But I don't think this is true, and I don't think it's true based on the record. For example, two of my five executive vice presidents at Thomas Nelson were women. And one reader wrote, and this is a quote, she said, "I agree with you that marriage should be honored, but two of your guidelines seem discriminatory towards professional women, the ones about eating and traveling alone. As a professional woman who's working in male-dominated industries, I would have been very lonely and left out of projects if my peers had followed your advice. I think it is better advice to regard women as professionals and people, ! We are not allowed to break up your marriage only to do our jobs and advance in our careers. Sure, there will be occasions when attraction comes into play, but be aware and use good sense in those cases. How do you handle it when one of your female direct reports needs to go out with you or to an out-of-town meeting? Do you require her to stay behind?" End quote. Well, first of all, I think it's a great comment. This raises some really important issues that I want to address. And first, my advice applies equally to men and to women. I don't have this view, you know, that women are dangerous and, you know, men are victims and they have to be careful. No, it has nothing to do with that. I don't think women are dangerous. I don't think they're out to break up marriages. I don't think this is true of men either. I just don't want to give myself or anyone else an opportunity to do something stupid in a moment of weakness. In terms of how I handle it, when one of my direct reports needs to go with me to an out-of-town meeting, we just bring a third person. Yes, it costs a little more, but it's worth the additional investment, especially if you've ever reaped the consequences of adultery in your organization or in your company. The cost is infinitely more than this small cost of investing in additional travel. In fact, I would also argue that this policy creates more opportunities because that third person who otherwise wouldn't be asked gets to go on trips, gets to go to lunches, gets exposed to lots of stuff that they otherwise wouldn't get exposed to. So I think it's a good policy, and I practiced it and encouraged my direct reports to practice it as well. But obviously, you can do what you want. These are my guidelines. Yours may be different. And by the way, if you have different guidelines, I'd love to hear them fleshed out, and you could do those in the comments, and I'll give you a link here just in a little bit. Regardless, I don't want to be legalistic. I'm simply arguing that you must be intentional. Set appropriate boundaries. Personally, I think you want boundaries that avoid the appearance of evil, just to, you know, keep the rumor mill from being stoked. And I think you want to protect yourself from making a dumb decision that you will regret for the rest of your life. It's just not worth it. I mean, if you look at it objectively, it's just not worth it. No one in their right mind would make the trade that they make in a moment of weakness, which costs them everything, not the least of which is their relationship with their friends and their family and their reputation and their legacy and all the rest. So the third commitment I would encourage you to make is this one of setting specific boundaries. The fourth commitment is, and this may sound surprising, but to speaking well of your spouse. I wrote a blog post about this called, quote, "Why speaking well of your spouse is so important," end quote. And it got over 9,000 Facebook likes, 2,000 retweets, and almost 2,000 comments. Obviously, this hit a nerve. And I would encourage you to read the post. I've got a link in the show notes to it. But here's the short version. Early in our marriage, Gail and I attended a church that was led by this dynamic 30-something pastor. He was an extraordinary communicator. He was a wise and empathetic counselor. And as a result, the church really grew rapidly. But as we got better acquainted with him and his wife, we started noticing a disturbing trend in the way that they related to one another. They would often make disparaging remarks about the other in public, and at first it seemed cute. Their comments seemed playful, humorous. Everyone laughed. But over time, they became more and more biting. Obviously, they were frustrated with one another, and this was their way, an unhealthy way, I might add, of dealing with it. Now, we ultimately left that church, but several years later, we learned that they had suffered an ugly divorce, both admitting to multiple affairs. They lost their family and, of course, their ministry. And to this day, it grieves me to think about it. But contrast this to Sam Moore, my predecessor at Thomas Nelson. He always, to this day, and he's in his 80s, always speaks highly of his wife. He would tell us, as his direct reports at Thomas Nelson, he says, "I hate to leave her in the morning, and I can't wait to see her in the evening." Now, they've been married for over 60 years. Last time Gail and I were with them over lunch, they were holding hands as they left. It was obvious they are still in love. But reflecting on these two experiences, I'm convinced that praising your spouse in public is one of the most important commitments you can make to grow your marriage and to impact your leadership. And this is important for at least five reasons. Reason number one is that you're going to get more of what you affirm. Have you ever noticed that when someone praises you, you want to repeat the behavior that caused it? Look, this is just human nature. It can be a form of manipulation if it's not genuine, of course, but it can also be a powerful way to motivate others when it's authentic. Reason number two, affirmation shifts your attitude toward your spouse. Words are powerful tools. They can create, they can destroy, they can build up, or they can tear down. And I believe most people have a drive to align their actions and their attitudes with their words. So if you start speaking well of someone, you start believing what you say about that person. Reason number three, affirmation helps strengthen your spouse's best qualities. Encouragement's also a powerful force for good, and all of us need positive reinforcement. This is why when we're losing weight and people notice, it gives us the strength to stick with the program, doesn't it? This is true in every area of life. Reason number four, affirmation wards off the temptation of adultery. When others see you're happily married, when you speak well of your spouse in public, they're less likely to proposition you or to make a pass or to make a move towards you. It's a hedge that protects your marriage from would-be predators. It's the best form of adultery repellent I know of. You simply stop being a target when you praise your spouse in public. Reason number five is that affirmation provides a model to those you lead. This is so important. If you're going to be a truly effective leader, you must lead yourself, and then you must lead your family. And your marriage, as I said earlier, is a powerful visual of how you treat the people you value the most. When you speak highly of your spouse, your followers, the people you're leading, are more likely to trust you. It takes your leadership to another level. So just in summary, if you want a successful long-term marriage, make these four commitments. Commit to continuing education. Be a lifelong learner. Commit to spending time together. Commit to a specific set of boundaries. And number four, commit to speaking well of your spouse. Now, let's get to some questions. I had somebody call in anonymously. This is actually the first time this has ever happened. And I probably should have encouraged people as they responded to be anonymous if they wanted to, because this is, after all, a very sensitive area. But this is what this lady had to say.
What do you suggest doing when it seems your husband enjoys emailing and typing and reading blogs more than talking to his wife? How does she get his attention? How do you establish some kind of regular pattern of more intimate communication? Thank you.
Well, first of all, as much as I hate to admit it, I've been that guy. You know, I've been preoccupied with email or reading blogs or watching a television show and not paying the kind of attention to my wife and kids that I should. And I'm going to suggest something you may not like. And I don't mean to be offensive or abrupt, but it would be easy in this situation to play the role of the victim by making him the bad guy, or if it's your wife doing it, her the bad guy, and you're the innocent party. And there's probably some truth in it. If I were talking to him, it would be an entirely different conversation. But let's assume that his behavior is in some part your responsibility. And though this initially sounds harsh or difficult, taking responsibility for something like this can be tremendously liberating. Why? Because it gives us back control. We're not powerless. We're not victims. We have agency, the ability to affect the outcome. So if it depended on you alone to just turn this situation around, what would you do? I mean, you could just kind of hope that he gets better or that he loses interest in the internet and starts focusing on you. But what can you do? That's what I want to focus on. Well, for starters, and again, this sounds harsh, you could perhaps become a more interesting person. Are you growing spiritually and intellectually? Are you the kind of person he wants to be around? In other words, are you positive, encouraging, energetic? Are you taking care of yourself physically? So think about becoming a more interesting person. Also, perhaps you could suggest activities that you could do as a couple. For example, rather than attacking his behavior directly, you could suggest that you go for a walk and debrief on the day's activities. Perhaps you could share your needs, again, without attacking his behavior, but just be honest about what you need from him. I've only been a man, so I can't respond as a woman, but I can tell you that men don't wake up each morning deciding how they can make their wives' lives miserable. That just doesn't happen. We just kind of do it naturally. You know, we tend to be preoccupied, tend to be selfish, and maybe I'm speaking for all humans. Maybe I'm speaking for no one other than myself. But again, my guess is that he has no idea what impact this is having on you. So maybe you need to share your needs. Never, when you're dealing with a man, never assume anything, especially that they know something that you think is obvious. And if that doesn't work, and this is probably a last resort, but perhaps you could confront him on his behavior. You know, it's probably not going to get better unless somebody makes the first move and determines that they're going to change it. Now, maybe you're thinking, well, that won't work with him, or what if he doesn't respond? Well, that's possible, but it for sure is probably not going to happen if you don't try. And leadership is first and foremost about initiative. If you're going to lead, you've got to take initiative, and you've got to accept the reality that it's always your move, no matter what. The next question comes from my friend, Eric Fisher. Eric, take it away.
Hi, Michael. This is Eric Fisher from Beyond the To-Do List podcast. Found at beyondthetodolist.com. Thanks again for being an interviewee on the show. I had a question. It was, can you give me some insight on how you and your wife made sure to have time not only for the business conversations of making sure the family business ran right, you know, strengthening your parenting partnership with your wife, as well as, say, having regular social conversations, especially while having a house filled with five girls. I have an almost 8-year-old daughter and a 1-year-old son, and it often feels like our hands are full with just those two. So I'm interested in seeing how you did that. Thanks, Michael.
Well, Eric, I addressed this in the second of my marriage commitments, but let me just elaborate here because there's a few more things that I'd like to say about it. First, you must absolutely make time for this. You've got to have a time when you're not talking about work or the kids. But how do you do that if you don't seem to have the time or the money? And again, my answer is that you must first start with an intention to do it. When you do that, then suddenly the resources will show up, and they usually don't show up unless you have the intention. So the time and the money are not going to magically fall out of the sky. You've got to have an intention. And my premise is that what gets scheduled gets done. Put it on your calendar, your date night, your weekend retreats, your vacation, whatever. So you might want to check out my annual time blocking tools, and they're the tool, and there's a link in the show notes. But this is basically the process of looking ahead a year and making time for the truly important activities, for your priorities, so that they get done and that time doesn't get stolen or hijacked by something of lesser importance. The first challenge you're going to have if your kids are young, obviously, is finding a babysitter. And I know this can get expensive, but here are a few options. And again, you can apply your own creativity to it, but you can ask your parents or another relative. And I see my girls do this with one another all the time. They certainly do it with us. And you don't want to abuse this, but you know, that's one of the advantages. If you have relatives living close, it's one of the advantages that's kind of built into the mix. You can also barter a skill you have for the babysitting you need. For example, how about I fix your car on Saturday morning in exchange for you watching our kids on Saturday night? What is it that you could offer in exchange for some babysitting? You could also swap babysitting with some close friends who have the same objective. For example, we'll watch your kids on Friday night. You watch ours on Saturday night. That way we both have a date night. Or then sacrifice something in order to pay for babysitting. Your money's naturally going to flow to your priorities, but what's more important, your daily dose of Starbucks or a weekly date with your spouse. So you might have to be creative. You may have to make a sacrifice, but this is totally possible if you start with the intention. Also, you don't have to go to a fancy, expensive restaurant. There are many times we went to a cheap fast food joint. You can even pack a basket and go on a picnic or just take snacks or simply go out for coffee. The important thing is to have a place where you can focus on one another and get involved in a deeper conversation where you're learning and growing together and exploring one another's personalities and hopes and dreams and aspirations and all the rest. If necessary, you can even have a date night in. Just decide that one night you're going to put the kids to bed and then do something together. The key is together. You know, if you're going to watch a movie, great, but build in some conversation to it as well. The intention is where it all begins. Imaj also asked another question from a single person's point of view.
Hi, Michael. My name is Imaj. I'm a country singer calling from on tour. We're headed to Florida. As the wearer of a purity ring with fans who share the same view, I speak for many when I ask, what protective measures are there for those who experience a serious relationship for the first time? My blog is on facebook.com/imajofficial. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if you could make out the question. I know there was some background noise there, but let me just repeat it. Essentially, Imaj was asking, as a single person who has a purity ring and who has an intention to remain pure, in other words, not to have sex before marriage, she's wondering if there are some boundaries or some measures that single people can take who are in a serious relationship for the first time. Great, great question, Imaj. This shows me that you're intentional about your life and you're not just going with the flow. That puts you ahead of about 90%, 95% of the people out there. The first thing I would encourage you to do is to think through your own standards or boundaries. Write them down. What are you committed to before marriage? Where are you going to draw the line? You're going to draw the line somewhere. It's either going to be intentional or it's going to be unintentional. And it's either going to be something that serves the relationship or ends up something that destroys the relationship. So be intentional. Set your standards, set your boundaries, and actually write them down. Second, I would encourage you to have a conversation with the person you're in the relationship with. Your goal is alignment. Talk it through. This would be a great exercise in deepening your relationship, but talk about the outcome that you want and how these boundaries can serve the outcome. And by the way, the rules or the boundaries are never an end in themselves. They're employed in the service of a higher objective, something that's precious or important to you. And when you do that, then the boundaries make sense and they're not burdensome. Third, I would discuss how you're going to handle it when you step over the line or are tempted to step over the line. And I would give one another permission to throw a flag on the play, you know, to blow the whistle, to call foul. And if the other person won't respect your boundaries, you're in the wrong relationship, period. I just talked to a girl a couple of weeks ago. This was a girl that was an adult, about 30 years old. And she talked about this relationship she had with this man that she loved, but he would not respect her boundaries. He kept pushing her and she was very uncomfortable with it. And I just challenged her to ask, no matter what her feelings were, is this the guy that she can really respect and spend a lifetime with if he won't respect her now? I mean, you know, before the marriage, people are on their best behavior. It does not usually get better after marriage. So if he's going to violate your boundaries now and not respect them, what is it going to be like after you're married? That's a question you've got to ask. And fourth, I would find someone to hold you accountable. Maybe it's another couple. Maybe it's an older couple. Maybe it's your pastor or a spiritual director, but somebody that can hold you accountable to the boundaries that you've written down, discussed, and agreed on together. So that's about all the time we've got for questions. I want to leave you with this question, and I hope that you respond to this on my blog, in the show notes, at the end, in the comments section, but is to think about the couples you know who have been happily married for a long time. What are the habits or the practices that you observe in their marriage that have served them well? So to comment on this episode, go to my blog at michaelhyatt.com/025, as in episode 25, michaelhyatt.com/025, and I'll do my best to answer any other questions that you may have. One announcement, if you're ready to get serious about building your platform and taking your blogging to the next level, You can't do better than launching a self-hosted WordPress blog. And that's what nearly all professional bloggers use. That's what I use at michaelhyatt.com. And if you're a little technically challenged, if you've been afraid to try and install WordPress on your own, I've got great news. A few weeks ago, I produced a free screencast called How to Set Up a Self-Hosted WordPress Blog in 20 Minutes or Less. The short video will take you through the process, click by click. Trust me, anybody can do this. And you can find that screencast at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup. There's a link also in the show notes. Well, that's about it for this episode of This Is Your Life. I'd also be grateful if you would rate my podcast on iTunes. That helps tremendously with keeping my podcast visible so people who have never heard of it can discover it. If you'd like to comment on this episode, please go to michaelhyatt.com, go to the show notes for this episode, and scroll down to the comment section. I would love to hear from you. Comment, question, whatever is on your mind, let me hear from you. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Go make it count. This is your life. Are you?